who,
you were kidding.
You guessed it, was married to Glenn. I'm not sure which wife she was, but she was married 23 times. And good news, everybody, she's on the lookout for more. So if you've got a single friend who may want to get married, Noah, you know? I mean, think about all the wealth you probably accrued due to the bit different divorce settlements, right? So
We're lost.
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting concept of, I mean, why would you marry somebody with 28 former marriages where he probably couldn't even name his ex-wives, right? But it kind of brings up, you know, just on a more practical level. I mean, you've probably known people with many marriages. Some of you have had divorces in your past. I know that. But let's go to the introduction here. Let's say Gretchen met the man of her dreams who has all the qualities which she could ever hope for in a future spouse. He is godly, involved in church, rather attractive. However, Gretchen finds out that he has had a divorce. What concerns should she have at this point?
Oh, find out what the divorce, why was he divorced?
Okay.
Kind of, you know, once you figure that out, you can kind of ask other questions.
Okay.
Like, what point in his life was he not a Christian at the time?
Yeah, was he a Christian when the divorce happened?
Yeah.
Okay. There's some other issues.
If he was a willing party.
Okay, if he is the one who initiated it. Mm-hmm.
What role his church had in the process.
Okay. Yeah.
Does he have children?
Mm-hmm.
Is he loving Jesus and following Jesus passionately today?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe how long ago did the divorce happen? Yeah, so, this is a issue, I guess. Noah and Ben, are you guys, you're two single guys. Oh, we got another one, too. So, Sarah, we have three singles, right, in this class right now. Anybody else single about? Okay. But yeah, I mean, this is actually one of the issues where when I talk about dating and when I address singles, I always kind of talk about this issue. Right? Why is it important as a single person to kind of know what's up with this, with regards to this topic? Noah, go ahead.
Well, the Bible has pretty strong language about divorce and remarriage.
Yeah.
Like, depending on which gospel you go to, but.
Okay. And we'll talk about that, yeah. Yeah, why else is it very important to think through this issue?
That's a pretty big thing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if it's someone in their young 20s or, you know, in their 20s, that's a pretty big life event to have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it can showcase a lot of their character.
Yeah.
So if you're able to kind of dig in and figure out what was going on, it can really
mm-hmm.
shine a light into who they are as a person and
mm-hmm.
what they actually believe.
Okay. Why else is it important as a single person to kind of have some convictions about this area?
Yeah, the older you get.
I'm not searching for anything. Do you have any answers, Alan? I mean, I have like five answers in my mind.
Okay.
Especially the older you get, the, you know, your possibilities of finding a guy who's never been married
are
less. And so you might be willing to compromise in this area.
Yeah, that is an excellent point, right? As you get older, you're an older single person, the amount of people who are still single and never married dramatically shrinks.
Okay. You know what time's running out then.
Yeah.
No pressure, Noah.
Yeah, you got the biological clock ticking. And I have seen on multiple occasions people conveniently change their convictions on this.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Okay. I've seen people conveniently change their convictions on it. Other thoughts on why it's important as a single person?
There's tons of baggage with that. So you might think, oh well, no problem. You know, it'll be all right this time.
Mm-hmm.
But every divorce has tons of baggage. So it's not like it never, you can't just check it off as, well,
yeah,
that's behind me now.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's all of that preceded it. I mean, there's a lot of...
Yeah.
There's other people.
That's what I mean. It's just a lot of...
Yeah.
Stuff there that
yeah. Happen. I mean, there's a difference between being widowed and divorced. I mean, when you're widowed, the memories of the marriage are happily preserved. But when you're divorced, it's like there's this big asterisk over this section of your life. Does that make sense? You know, that's kind of that really colors somebody. In a lot of ways, yeah. I think one thing is when you kind of understand the permanency of marriage, it's not a light commitment. It's not a light commitment. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the other issues later on, but it's a serious commitment till death do you part, and you have to kind of understand it. But, I mean, what would be the consequences of proceeding in a marriage with somebody with an unbiblical divorce? What are the consequences? Yeah, Ben.
Well, one of the concerns is that, you know, it takes two people to quarrel.
Mm-hmm.
And often that is a reason for divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, somebody can change their behavior, but often past behavior indicates what future behavior
yeah.
will be similar.
I mean, we'd draw a lot of comfort. You know, this is my fourth marriage, so I think I'm getting really good at it now. I think I'm really nailing it.
Fifth or six.
Yeah, fifth or six. Oh, yeah. It's kind of like when I say I've fasted multiple times a day. You know, that's not the real metric. Yeah, that doesn't really count. Right?
I've been divorced 3 times, so I'm getting pretty good at it.
I'm pretty good at it, yeah.
Well, I think, like, there's qualifications for marriage. And you're not married unless these things happen.
Uh-huh.
Just like, so you're not divorced unless these things happen. And so if it's an unbiblical divorce, are they actually divorced in the Lord's eyes? Because if they're not actually divorced in the Lord's eyes, then what you're doing is committing adultery.
Boom. That's the big one. So if you marry somebody with an unbiblical divorce, as we will establish, the reason why it is wrong primarily is because it's an act of adultery. It's an adulterous wedding. Okay, so light of all this, I mean, this is really good for us to think about from a single person, but why is it important for married people to think deeply about this issue? Any married people want to speak?
The question again?
Why is it important for married people to think deeply about this issue and have strong convictions about it?
I think it... your understanding of divorce is tied to your understanding of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
If we properly understand marriage, then divorce is never an option.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Yeah.
No matter what happens in our marriage, there's things that we can be counseled, we can do this and that.
Yeah.
But divorce is one of them.
Okay. That's good.
So I think your understanding of a biblical divorce, I mean, I think that's possible. But it's pretty narrow
mm-hmm.
passage there.
Yeah.
I think when I look at, like, I have friends who are married and unbelievers, and when I look at the way that we deal with conflict, it's very different.
Okay.
Sometimes
this is good.
When I look at conflict, I'm very strong-headed, and I just want it my way. And sometimes I look at that, and in my mind, I have to think, no, I have to live with David for the next X amount of years, and if I let this
I get to
live with this, and if I let this little thing that I really want my way on, is this really a big deal? No, it's not. But if I fight and fight for this, well, then that's going to have a big compound effect on the rest of our lives. And
yeah.
if I let this small seed grow, it's
yeah.
going to turn into this huge thing. And so, no, I have to nip it in the bud because I'm looking to the future
mm-hmm.
and knowing that I don't I have to make this work because I am married to him and I made a covenant before the Lord and mm-hmm. we are going to make this work and I want a happy, joyful marriage.
Yeah.
But I look at my unbelieving friends and they don't have that view. And yeah. if it doesn't work out, I'll just get divorced.
Yeah.
And so they let those conflicts that are small and meaningless run this giant thing.
Yeah.
And they have to get their way. And it's just, it's very different.
Mm. Yeah. That's good. Other thoughts?
I'm going to add to that. And also, when you have conflict, you can't press into it as deeply as you need to because your relationship is always at risk.
Yeah.
But when you have in your own marriage, you're established this commitment for life.
Yeah.
Then you can dig into the really hard things because neither one's going to run away.
Yeah.
That actually creates amazing depth and hope for peace and unity that you can't really have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
My one other thing would be when you're, for singles and married people, but especially as married people, you tend to hang out with other married people at times and you're going to end up counseling your friends.
Yep.
And they have fights and they have questions and they have doubts. And so if you have worked through those issues yourself and have deep convictions, then you're going to be able to give much better counsel when your friends have marriage problems. And there are a billion ways to have marriage problems. So it's not always so cut and dry.
But we also hang out with a ton of single people.
Yep.
And I think the counsel we give to our single friends mm-hmm. will... It's there.
Yeah.
And so we're either going to get really good counsel or really bad counsel to people we love.
Yeah. Yeah, I think having strong convictions about this topic disarms people too, where, like, for me to tell Becky, if you keep on keep this up, I'm going to get a divorce. Like, such a thing is not said in Israel, right? That is just not done. And I think some strong convictions on the topic means it's, like, to threaten divorce in a Christian marriage is, like, that is not done. Does that make sense? But I think in Christian marriages or non-Christian marriages where that's not an issue, it can be. You know, that's often a tool that people use to, you know, if you don't stop this, I'm going to get a divorce. If you don't do this, you know, so there's a way of kind of controlling people by having it there. So, I mean, that's one thing. Convictions make you weak. You know, they basically remove power from you because you are now subservient to the higher law, you know, the lawgiver and all that. And so, you know, what you think about divorce, it does. You could say it traps you in the marriage, right? But you're never really trapped in God's will. I mean, you're going to, you know, it's always an opportunity. And so, yeah.
Just one other thing, I mean, especially between Christian marriages and non, is that it's tied to our understanding of the gospel of Christ in the church.
Yeah.
And so what we believe about marriage and its the role of the wife and the love for one another.
Yeah.
It's going to reflect their understanding of the gospel.
Yeah.
And so if divorce is an option, how do you reconcile that with
the gospel? Yeah. So there's long-term ramifications as far as the Christian witness. So let's look a little bit of the background. I gave you some interesting stats and numbers here because that's always fun. One of the most troublesome trends of our day is the increase in divorce, remarriage, and broken homes. In the mid-1970s, the U.S. Census Bureau estimated that approximately a third of first marriages end in divorce. Second and third marriages fare worse. When you're in the 20s, it's over. I'm just kidding. You know, but for two-thirds are unsuccessful. But you have to factor in, like, you have, like, the Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, all these people who kind of gin up those numbers to bring that down. In the early 1990s, the U.S. divorce rate was approaching 50%, and in some states, it is even higher. In the 2000s, there's been a downward rate of divorce. In 2000, for instance, there were 4 divorces for every 1,000 people. But in 2014, the rate dropped to 3.2. However, it should be noted in 2000 there were 8.2 marriages for every 1,000 people, but the 2014 rate dropped to 6.9. So less people are getting married and choosing other options like cohabitation. About 60% of all marriages that eventually end in divorce do so within the first 10 years. A 2011 study at the University of Iowa found that a woman's loss of virginity before the age of 18 was correlated with greater number of occurrences of divorce within the first 10 years of marriage. Now, why do you guys think that might be? Thoughts on that? There's no right answer. I'm just kind of curious what.
There'll be a,
not a Christian moral value at that point.
Okay. At least not lived out.
Assume that, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, looking at the sin of adultery as something that's not forbidden.
Yeah.
Could be the cause of that.
Yeah.
Plus, there's a kind of a bonding, and if you're looking at it like, mm-hmm. Is serial monogamy or serial divorce? Mm-hmm. That's what we kind of have told our kids. Like, if you're gonna date seriously at mm-hmm. a young age, you're just practicing serial divorce.
Yeah.
As you lead up to marriage, just don't do that.
Yeah.
And then it kind of cheapen the mm-hmm. thing that is supposed to hold you together.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a sense where you think about maybe the first relationship that you've had. Let's say if you've never been married, and your marriage is your first relationship, I think that's great. If you had a girlfriend in the past or a boyfriend in the past, that first breakup was devastating. But each successive one after that gets a little bit easier, right? So here's another one that I thought was pretty interesting. A 2012 study cited by Pew Research Center found that an estimated 78% of women with bachelor's degrees and 65% of men with bachelor's degrees who married between 2006-2010 can expect their marriages to last at least 2 decades. Women with high school degree or less, on the other hand, faced a meager 40% probability of their marriages surviving that same period. Why do you think that's the case? Naomi, you're...
So I've read studies, I'm trying to gather all the thoughts into a coherent...
Okay, this is going to be great.
Thanks.
Yes.
So I have read studies in terms of the correlation between... I think Tim Keller brings it up in his... The meaning of marriage. Like, the way successful people... Mm-hmm. Tend to have some more solid marriages mm-hmm. because of the requirements that it takes, like long-term commitment, vision that can be applied in terms of the business world or the education field that could also be applied within marriage. And so I do, and I think that it's reasonable to expect someone who's grown up in a solid home and glimpsed a solid marriage between their parents to mm-hmm. be somewhat in one sphere equipped to reproduce that.
Okay.
And you can see how a more stable community that values marriages, whether Christian based on Christian ethics or not.
Yeah.
They would be setting up the next generation to do the same thing, and that would go hand in hand with things like education.
Like a stable family will produce more college students.
Right, right.
Who would in turn have that modeled so that they can apply it to themselves. Right. Yeah, there's probably a lot of truth to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, other reasons for that? Like, the older you get married, the more successful it seems to be.
Just said the older you get?
The older, that's the other metric too. Like, the older you get, the more successful it usually is. As in terms of staying married.
Mm-hmm. I would say typically you see a lot of the women that just graduate high school and don't move on to college. Either some of them, I would say, obviously not all because I don't go to college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but like most of the time they get married right out of high school or they're mm-hmm. in a shotgun wedding, so to speak.
Okay.
Instead of just, whereas people who are in college typically wait until they're out of college to get into a stable marriage.
Yeah.
When they're at a stable point in their lives.
Yeah.
Versus right out of high school, where it's not very stable.
Yeah.
I think you're looking at a culture here where less responsibility is put on our kids, mm-hmm. so they don't really get any real responsibility until they get out of the house, until mm-hmm. they get through college. So when they're getting right out of high school and getting married,
mm-hmm.
didn't have no real responsibility.
Yeah.
So all this great responsibility is thrust upon them and they fail.
Yeah. Ben?
Something that my siblings and I have noticed at the college that we go to, and it's a small private college, so I don't know if it happens everywhere, but students that come to campus and the freshmen, they're dating within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And
which college is this?
Sterling College.
Sterling College, okay.
They have a boyfriend or girlfriend and they're dating within 2 weeks, and they date all the way through college and they get married when they graduate. And so they've been together for 4 years,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of gives them a stable. They've gotten to see each other, how they perform in class, how they perform in sports,
mm-hmm.
how they perform in social activities. So mm-hmm. they've kind of gotten to know each other fairly well in a fairly stable environment.
Yeah.
Does this also take away some of the economic strain if you have degrees?
Yeah.
Probably the assumption is that you have a job.
You have a job, you're stable.
Mm-hmm. Right, you're not struggling with something like
that. Dave Ramsey is a big one on that finances are one of the biggest problems for divorce. So that would be
Well, I mean, like, I got married when I was 20,
mm-hmm.
and David was 26.
Uh-huh.
And for me, one of the attractive qualities about David was that he had his life together.
Yeah.
You know, he had things. He was financially stable, and he was, you know, that was...
Mm-hmm.
Was attractive to me because the guys my age that were 20, 21 did not have those things.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, I knew getting married to him that he would be able to provide for me, and there was no, there wasn't a question in my mind about that. And, you know, my parents talked to him about that too and made sure of that, but
mm-hmm.
it was very different than the guys that were my age who, you know, if I were to marry someone my age, we would have struggled for years to try to get financially stable.
On top of everything else,
yeah,
you'd have that element
too.
Yeah,
on top of being newly married, now you're struggling with, you know, I think Sarah kind of touched on that, when you do get married young to someone else who's young,
mm-hmm.
you guys don't have an established career, you don't have an established place of living, you're just kind of struggling.
Mm-hmm. Scott?
Yeah, it's, when we think about, like, which marriages in divorce and which don't, and we look at, like, education, that where they had previous divorce, or like all these different factors, age. It also reminds me that we, when you talked about the culture, it seemed like our, like you made mention this when we were talking about abortion, that there's a desire to separate every single factor of
mm-hmm.
sex is separate, kids are separate, marriage is separate, cohabiting, like you should. The culture wants to be able to choose any of those options in any combination.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to cohabit and have kids, but
mm-hmm.
not be married, or I want to be able to be married and not do this,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so trying to split all of those things apart, you know, it splinters everything. And so there's kind of this have it your way kind of,
mm-hmm.
desire that it's hard for to talk to the culture about what is a marriage and why should someone get married. So I have
mm-hmm.
a friend, a coworker that young, she's college educated, has a job, and has cohabitated with her boyfriend a long time.
Yeah.
They talk about whether or not they'll get married someday or whether they'll have kids someday and first, and
mm-hmm.
it's just a very different view of, like, what is the purpose of marriage?
Yeah.
How does it relate to all those other...
Yeah. I think there's one thing that we need to keep in mind in a church, where in a church that advocates the sexual ethic with young people, that you need to wait till marriage before you have sex. A lot of times, I think, and I've seen this, couples want to get married sooner than it's wise to do so. And often what drives the decision is sex. And where it's not about who is this person, you know, where are they going, where are they, like, on, where's their spiritual trajectory going? It's like, how soon can I have sex? Does that make sense?
With a qualified person.
With a qualified person. You know, you fit all the check marks. and so let's try to get married as soon as possible. So I think there's some, you know, just as a parent and stuff like that, it's like, you know, helping our kids even navigate some of those decisions with dating and putting themselves in a situation where, you know, I'm, you know, they're dating as a sophomore in high school, and what can they do? Do you know what I'm saying? So understanding divorce and remarriage and even the permanency of marriage and even having wisdom about what marriages are easier than others. Like, I'll tell you, I got married at 27, so 18 years tomorrow, by the way. So,
wow.
Yeah. But I was a much better husband at 27 than I would have been at 22 and at 18. You know what I'm saying? So I think part of like having a high view of marriage is really good for single people to have, because you know what you're getting into. That this is not just a shortcut to sex. This is a lifetime commitment, and these are the duties. And I mean, at 19, I would have told you, I'm not ready for marriage.
I think sometimes we focus a lot on sex.
Yeah.
And to the neglect of the other things that are important. You know,
yeah.
You look at these guys, is it Josh Harris?
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, who, they live this celibate teen years and maybe even in their early 20s and then marry and think that this is the formula for having this amazing
mm-hmm.
marriage, and then come to find out there's more
yeah.
to it than that.
Yeah.
Right, so I think it would be, I'd like to see that even in our youth.
Mm-hmm.
We have discussions, but
yeah,
you know, helping our kids navigate all of those
yeah.
aspects.
I tell my boys, the more mature you are, the more stable you are, the more attractive you'll be to the right person. And there is just a wisdom, like, I would not have been able to nab Becky at 22.
Well,
but by waiting till
like
I
14 or something.
Heather? Heather? I'm not Roy Moore, okay? You know? It's, no, I would not have been able to nab a woman like Becky.
Right.
Becky's caliber at 22.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So I always tell my boys that, you know, you kind of wait and you're patient, you kind of grow in these areas, it really helps out. So I think having an understanding of divorce or remarriage and the permanency of marriage, I think even helps us kind of shape the young people and steer them where if you want to get a good wife, you figure your life out first before you ask. And even the biblical custom of marriage, that was usually the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
When the guy wouldn't give up his daughter until he was convinced that he had his life figured out. So it's kind of like, we're going to get married at 18 and wait tables and work at Burger King, and we're going to make it work because we love each other. Yeah.
Another is the opposite side of that, and I don't know if this is the way it is in Emporia.
Okay.
Definitely in city context, is people wait too long.
Yep.
And that's actually what we deal with in Mexico City. We have a lot of people in their mm-hmm. late 20s, early 30s.
Yep.
And the question is, okay, are you radically following Jesus? Yes. Are they radically following Jesus? What more do you need to know about this person at this point in your relationship?
Yeah.
Nothing. Well, then get married. Like,
yeah.
And that's what our push is, the opposite. It's not wait until all your ducks are in order. It's you have enough. You
yeah.
know the person enough. You have a church committed to you. You're committed to Jesus. Let's do this thing.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point. I've seen that too. It's like the longer the women wait, there's like Jesus and maybe settle for the Apostle Paul. Right.
Yeah. And some men, they want to have everything in order. They want to make sure they're financially stable in a way that they actually don't have to be.
Yeah.
They need to be stable enough to be able to lead their wife and follow Jesus with them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the same thing's
point.
True with kids. A lot of
mm-hmm.
friends, well, how are you going to afford them? Well, you're never going to. You can't afford your life now. And, you know, there's never a time where it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's Sandy. Sandy's about to speak, so we want to.
Oh, the major.
I think that our society, in general, not just now, but always, has always had a wrong concept about happiness. They think their marriage is going to make them happy, and they think being happy is everything.
Yeah.
When really, you know, your whole thing about whether you're following Jesus is important too, but you also have to figure out that, you know, is it about happiness? And your spouse isn't going to make you happy. It's not. But that's, it, you know, I can think of gobs of women that I've talked to over the time that, you know, just thought, well, I thought he was going to make me happy.
Yeah.
So, you know, it isn't about that.
Yeah.
And that's a hard truth,
yeah,
I think, for lots of people to face, especially somebody who thinks they've waited or whatever, and then this person didn't make me happy in the end. So,
that's why it's so important to go into it knowing that divorce isn't an option. Right?
Yeah. So in light of that, so that was all our introduction. So you guys excited about divorce and remarriage now, huh? So I think it's important to have some settled convictions on it. Now, I think, well, the Bible clearly teaches, you know, what God has joined together, let no man separate. The two become one. Marriage is intended to be a permanent union that is dissolved only unto death. But since we're going to talk about divorce or remarriage, there are some exceptions. So let's turn to Matthew 19, 3 through 9. This is the most explicit teaching on divorce in Scripture. So does somebody want to read that for me?
Some Pharisees came to Jesus, testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" He answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" He said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery."
Okay. So what issue did the Pharisees raise with Jesus?
Lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all.
Yeah. And so they are drawing attention to a passage that was at the center of a national debate in Israel. It's basically Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And Scott, you want to read that for me?
Sure. You want me to read just the verses or the commentary?
The verses.
Okay. So when a man takes a wife, marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies, she says to be his wife. Mm-hmm. And her former husband, who sent her away, is not allowed to take her to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord. You shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance.
Okay. So this was at the center of a national debate. The key word here that was at the center of the debate was some indecency. And so you had two schools of thought. You had the Hillel view, which believed that some indecency can refer to anything really at the husband's discretion, from sexual morality to burning toast to not being able to bear a child. The Shammai school was very restrictive, and they would say some indecency would be adultery. So they were more the hardliners, okay? So what was the command of this passage? I mean, what was the overall central thrust of it? Can't take her back. Okay, if you send her away, you can't take her back. So, in what case was this divorce permitted?
Well,
right? Was it just adultery?
Sounds like it was the husband's option.
Husband's option, but he had to find some indecency, right? There had to be some infraction. So the question is, what was the infraction? Is it limited to adultery? Look at that passage in Leviticus 20:10. If the wife committed adultery, what was his option?
Death,
yeah. Stone her to death. And then, guess what? He'd be free to be remarried, right? So some indecency might have been something beyond that. Could have been he discovered she wasn't a virgin when, you know, as promised when they got married, or some other lewd conduct that went in there where he could write a certificate of divorce.
But that would have been Joseph's option, you know, when he found that Mary was pregnant.
Yeah, that kind of would have been one of the options, yeah. Yeah, and they were not officially married at that point. They were kind of legally bound to get married. That's a little bit different. But if a man sent a woman away without a certificate of divorce, what hope would she have of remarriage and why? Yeah.
Swimming in.
Yeah, in that kind of society, I mean, if a woman got a job, often what was it? A prostitution, right? So he would essentially be forcing the woman, you know, his ex-wife that he divorced, into, let's say, prostitution forever. But by her having a certificate of divorce, that would make her eligible to do what?
To be
married, right? So why couldn't the former husband take the claim to verse 4?
She has been defiled.
Yeah. And that is a what? Abomination. So what's the abomination? Why would that be an abomination for him to take her back? What did he force her into? Yeah, so he forced her into adultery. Right? She was your wife, but you forced her into adultery. And now by you marrying her, you're committing adultery with an adulteress of your own creation. And that's the abomination. Okay. Does that make sense? So that's kind of the general thrust of that passage. So note, why then is it remarriage an abomination? Once the reason for the woman's defilement is understood, the answer becomes clear. The reason the remarriage is mentioned in 24:4 is abominable is that it is abominable to marry an adulteress. Under normal circumstances, she should be executed, but OT law made this exception because she was pushed into adultery by the first husband, who divorced her for indecency and put her on the street with nowhere to turn in that society but to another man. Yet when she loses the second husband, she is permanently off limits to even her first husband, who cannot take her back since she has been defiled. Okay, so in some ways, this was a protection for women. It was a concession to have the certificate of divorce. Okay? So what was meant as a protection for women was being used by both of these schools to find, to give men a rationale for putting away their wives. You know what's really interesting, too, is when you looked at it, you know, their understanding of adultery, and this is something that Jesus actually sets straight, is that if a man were to sleep with a prostitute, a married man were to sleep with a prostitute, that would be considered fornication. A man could only commit adultery if he slept with another man's wife. Isn't that interesting?
Because they viewed it more as a sin against the man.
Yep.
And against the woman.
So, and there's some language in this passage where you see that if a man sleeps with another woman who's not his wife, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman, regardless if she's married or not, commits adultery. Isn't that interesting? So you see in this passage, Jesus actually broadens the scope of their understanding of adultery. That's not just a man with a married woman. is a man who puts away his wife, who is married, sleeps with any woman. So in Matthew 19:4-6, what does Jesus lay down as God's standard, and on what basis? What's the original standard that he has?
God is joined together with no man's
thing. Yeah, and where does he get that from? What's the basis?
Genesis 2,
right? The creation account. So what question do the Pharisees fire back in verse 7? Okay, so notice they say, why does Moses command? Okay, you see how they're taking that passage. Now, why did God allow for divorce? He didn't say, I don't say command, but why did he allow for divorce?
Hardened heart.
They're hardened heart, right? You know, because if you're hardened heart, you put her in danger. So this was just to regulate. So what does Jesus label divorce and remarriage in verse 9?
Whoever divorces except for immorality.
Yeah. Commits adultery, right?
Another man, well,
just any other woman. Doesn't have to be another man's wife, but any other woman.
Right, okay.
So, again, this is a huge passage as far as expanding the understanding of adultery. That if you leave for if you divorce your wife and marry a prostitute or do that, you are at issue. You are at fault. You're actually committing adultery.
So how common was it for them to do that, to give certificate of divorces? I mean, was that a pretty...
Common enough that it was a national debate. And common enough that God had to make a law regulating it. Yeah.
So when in the Matthew passage, mm-hmm. you talk about Moses' command, mm-hmm. and you're talking about the debate, is there multiple verses, or is it the Deuteronomy 24? It just strikes me that the Deuteronomy 24 seems more like a description. You know, mm-hmm. when this happens.
When this happens.
And divorces.
Yeah.
But it seems to be missing the, if this happens, you may, it seems to describe a situation that's ongoing.
Yeah.
Not prescribing any sort of action.
Just regulating it. Mm-hmm.
So are they saying Moses commanded or from that passage? Or?
Yeah, that is the passage where they extract it from. There's one in Exodus where it talks about if you were to take an additional wife in like a conquest, you have to be able to provide the same conjugal rights and food and all this other stuff. And the implication would be that if you don't, then she's not your wife anymore. But that was kind of a rare conquest situation, especially in the context of Exodus. But this would have been the passage that was the subject of the national debate. Well, you know that because we have access to a lot of writings at that time, and we know which school of thought advocated what understanding of that passage. But it's interesting, they focus on the exception clause, but the major content of that passage is what you see in verse 4, that you can't take it back because that would be an abomination. Yeah.
I have a question that you may touch on later on, because I probably won't be here for that. So, in the Deuteronomy passage, it's partially protecting the woman. The assumption mm-hmm. is if the man divorces her, then she's going to have to remarry.
Yeah.
In the Sermon on the Mount, elsewhere in Matthew, it has a similar argument, a mm-hmm. slight change. He says in Matthew 5, mm-hmm. 31 and 32, mm-hmm. it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery.
Yeah.
So it's similar to chapter 19, but one phrase, mm-hmm. kind of a question in the life of Deuteronomy, he says, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery.
Uh-huh.
It sounds similar to Deuteronomy, where the assumption the woman will have to remarry.
Yeah, that's true.
So how does that function within the church? I mean, this is the Sermon on the Mount, the description of how God's people ideally should mm-hmm. live. if a man unbiblically divorces his wife,
mm-hmm.
Jesus' statement seems to assume
mm-hmm.
that she therefore will get remarried.
Yeah. Yeah, he makes her commit adultery. And it's interesting, Matthew 19. So one of the reasons why you shouldn't do it is because you force her into adultery.
Yeah.
And then the reason in Matthew 19 is you commit adultery.
Yeah.
So all the way around is it's the murder of marriage.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's the same thing from two different perspectives.
I think I'm thinking of counseling a woman who's been inappropriately divorced by her husband.
Yeah.
Jesus' statement seems to assume she's going to remarry.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and part of that is regulated by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So there is further elucidation of it. But yeah, that would be the expectation, because what options did women have in Israel at that time? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But is your question like, by counseling her to remarry, are you counseling her to be an adulterer?
Well, it seems like this is Exodus 22,
right.
Jesus' statement, where the assumption is she's going to have to remarry, and he's saying, of course she's going to remarry, as if that were
you force her.
It's okay in the sense that where she's, of course, going to remarry, but he's also saying it's an act of adultery if she does remarry. So in the real world, maybe in modern America, a woman doesn't have to remarry. There's much more.
Well, there is a sense where that's a true exposition of Deuteronomy 24, where when you put a woman away for some indecency, you forced her into adultery.
Yeah.
And so what Jesus is saying is, it's not her, you take her back. It was your fault that she committed this sin.
Mm-hmm.
So he lays the blame of adultery on the man who pushed her out. So there is a sense where, because he's in a patriarchal society, he says, you're responsible for this. You have done this evil deed.
So Deuteronomy can't be because of sexual immorality, right? So we're saying he forces her to commit adultery. So that would be a non-biblical divorce in Deuteronomy, right?
Well, in Deuteronomy, he's regulating it. He's basically saying if some guy puts her aside because he finds some indecency, that is not prescribed, it describes what happens.
That's the point.
Kind of like slavery, you know, a lot of the regulations on slavery is not necessarily prescribed in the Old Testament, but it is regulated.
And so it seems that, you know, there's nowhere a passage that says in the Old Testament, you may give a divorce under this condition. It describes that when men get a divorce,
this is what they must do.
Right. And so
at least, if you're going to do this evil, at least have the decency to do this.
And it seems like the Pharisees were saying that when Moses describes the situation, he doesn't say when a man gets a divorce, put him to death. You know, like, well, that's a license to.
Yeah.
He permitted or he allowed or he commanded.
Yeah. So I'd say the indecency that they're talking about in Deuteronomy is something short of adultery. Because if it was adultery, she would be executed, and he'd be free to be remarried at that point. Now, that thought right there helps us understand why there seems to be like this broader allowance for divorce in the New Testament, which we will get to next time we discuss this in 2 weeks. Because next week, what are we doing?
Altar
Sunday School featuring Josh and Naomi.
Fireworks.
Get some fireworks.
We're going to keep with the study. It's pretty good. So.
Yeah. We were going to do like live action marriage counseling in front of the church.
We might even argue in front of you guys.
That'd be awesome.
Ooh.
That'd be awesome. So, all right. Well, Father, I do thank you for this opportunity to talk about a very important topic. And I pray that you will just help us to be a church that's pro-marriage. And I pray for any marriages that do struggle, that our convictions on this will, you know, really force all of us to turn to you and turn to your help to really bring a marriage to a point where it honors you and is stable and flourishing. Pray for the next phase of our worship service, that it will be a joyful occasion to celebrate you with our spiritual family. In Christ's name, amen.